death loosen from my heart for an instant, and I recoil in horror from the rampart. Raffaele pauses for the briefest of moments, then he clenches his jaw and fires his crossbow. The arrow strikes Enzo in the chest. He staggers but doesn't fall. Raffaele puts his arms up to defend himself, but his instant of hesitation has cost him. Enzo's strength is far beyond that of any human. He grabs Raffaele by the throat and slams him against the wall. Raffaele lets out a choked cry. Enzo's dagger flashes in the air. I don't think, I just act. I reach out through our tether and yank the threads of Enzo's energy tight, then I pull them toward me. Enzo lets out a snarl of irritation that barely sounds human. He turns his black eyes to me again. A thousand thoughts whirl through my mind. The threads of his energy that I'm holding are so cold they seem to burn through my consciousness, pulled so taut that they seem ready to break. I think back to the moment when Maeve had summoned him back from the underworld, how she had tied him to me. Now the tension of the strings of his energy cut at my mind. This is not him. Raffaele reloads, tightens his grip on his crossbow, and fires at close range. This arrow hits Enzo in the back. He fires again, another arrow. Enzo hunches, finally slowed by the attack, but the expression on his face doesn't change. His attention turns back to me, and, again, I feel the hands of Moritas through our tether. I am not yours yet, I think through the chaos, pushing defiantly against her. The darkness inside me crowds my chest, fighting Enzo's power. He shudders once at my touch. The steps around us turn black and are stained with illusions of blood, and the sky overhead takes on a scarlet tint. But I cannot control him this time. Enzo's soulless eyes lock on mine, his daggers flash toward me. Then abruptly he falls to one knee. His head bows. Behind him, Raffaele lowers his crossbow, and I see one final arrow buried in Enzo's back. The one that is finally struck true. Blood drips on the stones beneath our feet. A low, labored gasp comes from him as his second knee falls and the daggers clatter out of his hands. The tether between us trembles violently, and for an instant, I can feel the pain of his wounds as surely as if they were my own. I sink to the floor before him, unable to look away. He is dying. It doesn't matter anymore. The Enzo I once knew died a long time ago. Enzo looks up at me. Suddenly, the blackness in his eyes seems to fade, replaced by the familiar warm brown of his irises, the red slashes, the glow of life. I see a hint of his old self there, fighting through the darkness of the underworld to gaze at me one last time. It is the look he'd given me when we used to dance. This is the real Enzo. Let me go, he whispers. It is his voice. It is the voice that once comforted me, gave me strength. And as I try to take in his words, the final tendrils of the tether linking us unravel from around my heart, freeing me. Enzo collapses. As the last bit of my life and my light leaves him, he seems to turn gray, as if he could no longer contain the colors of the living world. He turns his head weakly in the direction of the ocean. The black pools in his eyes finally vanish, and a name drifts from his lips. He says it so quietly that I nearly miss it. It is not my name, but the name of another girl, one he had known and loved long ago. Then, he closes his eyes and sinks to the floor. His body grows still. I know without a doubt that he is gone. Raffaele says nothing. He stays against the wall, eyes fixed on Enzo. Then he pulls Enzo's body to him and leans over his head. The silence goes on. I walk forward in a daze, coming to a kneel beside them. Now I am close enough to hear Raffaele's quiet crying. He doesn't pay me any attention. In fact, it is as if I were not even here. After a long moment, he pulls away and lifts his jewel-toned eyes to me, the colors washed green and gold with tears. We stare at each other. I can see the confusion in his gaze as clearly as he must see the same in mine. You didn't have to save me. I am numb. I don't know what to do. The absence of my link to Enzo is a yawning chasm, a hollowness I first felt when Taryn took Enzo's life in the Estensian arena. How long had he been a part of my world? How had my life been before he stepped into it? All I can think is that I am losing him all over again, except that I already lost him. I am not ready to die. This realization strikes me hard. The terror I'd felt while crouching against the rampart makes me quake uncontrollably, haunting my senses. No, I'm not ready to die, and there is only one way I can prevent that from happening. As the sun starts to rise, I watch as Raffaele bends over Enzo's body, the two of us mourning the prince we both loved. Dearest Mother, I am afraid, for there is something he isn't telling me. It is not to do with our debt, I think, nor his conversation with the king, but it leads him on terrible midnight tantrums. Letter from Elena de la Maria to her mother, the Baroness of Ruby. Adelina Amuteru. First, I have conditions. I will go with Raffaele and the daggers on their journey, if I can bring my own crew and my own ship. Sailing alone on a vessel with them is out of the question. Maggiano must be released, alive and unharmed. Violetta stays with me. These are my terms. Tamora agrees to stand with us in exchange for a truce. I am not finished with my conquests yet. Although with Violetta back and our lives at stake, with my life at stake, my attention is shifted away from throwing my army at the Tamorans. It might be nice to have an ally for a change. Raffaele and the Golden Triad agree to all of these terms. So, a day later, Tamoran soldiers move me from my cell to the bathhouse, where two maids wash me and bind my hair in silks. Then I am taken to a real bedchamber in the palace, where I curl up in the bed and don't move again until the following afternoon. My hands stay chained, clutched near my chest as if to fill the new gap there. Enzo had been tethered to me for so long, and the strength of that connection was so persistent that its absence now makes me dizzy like I'm falling through the air. In my drowsy, half-awake state, I can see a ghost of Enzo walking alongside us, an illusion that disappears the instant I try to focus on him. Enzo is gone, returned to the underworld where he belongs. When will Violetta join him? The whispers ask me. Or Maggiano, when will you? Finally, days later, Raffaele arrives surrounded by soldiers. They release me. My wrists feel strangely light without chains weighing them down. We walk side by side through the palace corridors without saying a word. Something seems different in the energy between us now. Whether it's a barrier lifted or a tension eased, I'm not sure. Make no mistake, we don't trust each other, not by any stretch of the imagination. Perhaps Raffaele is playing with my emotions, as he often has. I certainly wouldn't put it past him to do such a thing. Of course he is, the whispers snap at me. Don't be a fool. He will wait until your back is turned. But for once, I have an easy time ignoring the whispers. There's something about shared grief that simplifies things, that cuts through the discord. Even if Raffaele might be manipulating me, The change may be genuine. I remember what he had once told me. Adelina, I loved him too. And so had I. I keep a fair distance between Raffaele and myself as we walk. He seems to do the same, and we don't look at each other as we make our way down the long steps of the Tamoran Palace's main gates, where horses are waiting for us. From there, we ride underneath a cloudy sky that threatens more rain. Several of my Kinetran ships have docked the western bay of Alamor. There is a wide expanse of plains here, dotted with desert shrubs and low grasses, the sharp cut of rocks lining the horizon where the city begins. The rising sun paints a red haze across the landscape, making the sea's foam turn red and orange. By the shore, the banners of my ships flutter in the wind. I feel the burden in my chest lighten at the sight, and the whispers stir happily. I'm no longer a prisoner. I am a queen again. The procession slows as we draw close. Now I can see my own troops lined up along the shore waiting for us. The white robes of the inquisitors look orange and cream in this early light, too, and in front of them waits Sergio, still adorned in the dark red armor of the roses. At the sight of me, they straighten. Not many paces away from my own troops are Tamoran soldiers, led by one of the three kings and flanked by Mikhail and Lucent. Then I see Violetta. She is far from me, surrounded by a patrol of Tamoran soldiers. One of them, an enormous bearded man, carries her in his arms. She's awake this morning and more alert than when I first saw her. Her eyes are trained on me. I can't turn away from her gaze. What is she thinking when she looks at me? A strange surge of relief rises in my chest, followed quickly by a slash of anger. I'd spent the better part of a year leading my troops into other territories, imagining what it would be like to find Violetta hiding amongst strangers. Now I found her, and she stares warily at me. She has the ability to wrench away the dagger's powers, but she chooses not to. Dark markings travel along her neck, disappearing under her robes. The sight of them reminds me of what is happening to her, of why we are all standing here. It makes me shiver. Violetta studies me. For an instant, I think she's going to reach out to my powers and yank them away as she once did. I feel a sudden wave of panic, but then she looks away. She doesn't say a word. I let out a small breath. "She's afraid of you," the whispers say, but I look away too. Then I notice Maggiano. He had been shrouded under a heavy robe, waiting with the Tamorans, but now he sees me and swings down from the horse he'd been sitting on. A smile breaks unbidden onto my face, and I turn my own horse instinctively in his direction. Beside me, Raffaele watches silently, no doubt sensing my emotions. But I don't care. Maggiano is here. Even from a distance, I can see the upturn of his lips, the familiar joy on his face. Our processions finally meet. Raffaele nods at the Tamoran troops, and they allow Maggiano to step forward right as I swing down from my own saddle. I keep my hands folded in front of me as he approaches. We stop short of touching each other. Maggiano looks tired, like all of us, but otherwise well. His long braids are loose today and blowing in the breeze. "Well, Your Majesty," he says, the teasing lilt back in his voice, "it looks like they caught you." "And you," I reply, unable to restrain my own smile. Raffaele walks forward first, completely unprotected, and nods at Sergio. "Hello, Rainmaker," he says. Sergio gives him a cold look. "A pleasure to see you again, messenger." Raffaele glances at us, then back at him. "The Tamorans have decided to release your queen. We have some things to discuss." That night, as our fleet remains docked, Raffaele joins Sergio, Maggiano, Lucent, and me for a meeting in my royal quarters. We are going to need to take this journey together, Raffaele tells us. His expression is dark, but his voice stays serene and calm. But we cannot do that if we don't trust each other. His face hardens again. Trust will come slowly for both sides. We give some, you give some. And who goes on this journey? Maggiano says, leaning forward as if to protect me. Lucent responds to his gesture with one of her own, turning herself toward Raffaele. Every elite in the world aligns with the gods in some way, Raffaele replies, folding his hands behind him. Orange candlelight flickers against his robes. The group of elites who go with us must comprise all 12 of the gods. Missing even one alignment will not give us the combination of energy needed to reach beyond the mortal world. The touch of immortality could overwhelm us. It would be fatal. The gemstones. The way Raffaele tested each of us. The memory flashes back to me, how he circled me slowly, watching my energy light up nightstone and amber and diamond and rosite and viridium. What had he found with my sister? He must have tested her by now, too. He'd also tested Sergio long ago, when he was still a member of the Daggers. Who will go with us? Raffaele looks at me. His eyes, jewel-toned and bright, honey gold and emerald green, seem to see straight through me. I remember yours quite vividly, Adelina, he says. Fear and fury, ambition, passion, wisdom. 5 of the 12. He nods at me. Your sister also aligns with fear. Fear. I'm not at all surprised. Fear is indeed something Violetta and I have shared since we were children. In addition to that, she aligns with joy and empathy, with happiness and sensitivity. Joy. Sensitivity. I think of Violetta's childish twirls, her ringing laughter, the way she used to carefully braid my hair. She's all of these things. I don't doubt Raffaele for a second. My heart aches as I think of her. Violetta is resting now in her own quarters on the ship. She still hasn't said a word to me.
What are yours?
Sergio asks Raffaele, unable to keep his dislike out of his voice.
You've never mentioned them.
Raffaele gives him a slight bow of his head. Wisdom, he replies, and beauty. Of course. Sergio grunts, unwilling to acknowledge Raffaele's words as he continues. Including Lucent's alignment to time, we comprise 9 of the 12 gods. Sergio, your alignments already overlap these, as do Mikkel's, so we need to find others with the 3 remaining alignments to death, war, and greed. He pauses to look at Maggiano. I would like to give you the same test that I gave the Daggers. Maggiano crosses his arms, suddenly indignant, but then he relents at a glance from me. Raffaele gestures to him. He reluctantly rises from the table and goes to stand in the middle of the floor.
I suppose you won't believe me if I discussed my alignments for you,
Maggiano mutters. Raffaele retrieves a satchel containing a series of raw, unpolished gemstones, just as he'd once done with me. He quietly places all 12 of the stones in a circle around Maggiano. Maggiano stands still, his body stiff. I can sense a note of fear over him, a cloud of wariness at Raffaele's intentions, but he doesn't move. When Raffaele finishes, he walks around Maggiano once, seeing which of the stones respond to his energy. After a while, 3 of the stones start to glow. Diamond, a pale white. Praise quartz, a subtle green. And sapphire, a blue as deep as the ocean. Raffaele starts to call on each of the gemstones in relation to Maggiano, the way he had called forth memories from my past when he tested me. Was this why Maggiano had such a penchant for sapphires?
why he attempted to steal an entire treasury's worth of them in the past, why he wanted the Night King's pendant so badly. Maggiano shudders slightly as Raffaele accesses the first of his memories. I wonder what Raffaele sees, and for a moment I wish I could see this glimpse into Maggiano's past, too. Maggiano reacts to each of Raffaele's tests, but stays calm throughout the exercise. They finally reach the last stone, the pale green praise quartz. Suddenly, Maggiano jerks away and steps out of the circle. He is shaking all over, the tiny note of fear hovering over him has exploded into a shower of sparks enough to stir my own power. Raffaele withdraws his hand. Get away from me, Maggiano snaps at him. I've never seen him so upset. He brushes past me without a glance, pushes past the table, and goes to stand before the porthole overlooking the midnight ocean. I frown and my heart seizes for him. His reaction reminds me so much of when Raffaele finally called on fear and fury in me, unleashing a storm of energy and ugly memories. What had he unearthed in Maggiano? Careful, messenger, I say, narrowing my eyes at Raffaele. Our alliance is not so solid that I wouldn't kill you for harming him. In the silence that follows, Raffaele sighs and folds his arms again. He returns my look. I cannot control how he responds to his alignments. Maggiano aligns with joy and ambition and greed. He needs to come with us if he's willing. He doesn't mention anything more about the test or Maggiano's reaction to it. I let out a short breath, relieved that I will have Maggiano with me on this trip. I start to ask what Raffaele must have seen, then stop short. I'll approach Maggiano about this later. Joy, ambition, greed. 10 of the 12 now. We need an alignment to Mortas and to Tristius, Raffaele replies. To death for the mortality of mankind, and to war for the eternal savagery of the heart. War and death. I know immediately that we won't find these traits in the elites among us if they don't already exist in me. Queen Maeve, Lucent says in a quiet voice, glancing sideways at Raffaele. She will align with Mortas. An uncomfortable silence. I can tell by everyone's expressions that we all know Lucent is right, even without Raffaele's test. Maeve, whose very power connects her to death itself, is undoubtedly a child of Mortas. But will she travel with our group? With me? Who destroyed her fleet not too long ago? And war? Raffaele answers. What of that? Lucent shakes her head. That I don't know. Suddenly, I realize something. It hits me so hard that it makes me gasp. Raffaele glances in my direction. What is it? He asks. I know. I know with absolute, searing certainty the elite who aligns with the final god. But he is no ally of mine or of anyone else, and he is waiting in chains in Kenetra. Terran Centauro, I reply, turning back to Raffaele. He will align with war.
Maggiano. In the first memory, the boy was 7 years old. When he asked his priest what his name was, the priest told him that he had no need for a name. He was the boy of Mensa, one of the young Malfettos chosen to live at the Mensa temple in Damaka, and this was the only name he would ever need. He trailed after the priest and looked on as she showed him how to properly tie down and slaughter a goat at the altar in front of the temple. She was kind and patient with him, and praised him for wielding the knife correctly. He remembered looking longingly at the meat, wishing he could eat it to fill the hollows of his stomach. But the Malfettos in the Damakan temples had to be fed very little. It kept them awake and alert, making it so that their senses were always on the prowl, searching for food. When he asked why this had to be, the priest told him gently that it was to strengthen his link to the gods, so that the priests could communicate through him. In the second Vemri, the boy was 9 years old, and the dark marking on his side now curved from the start of his ribs down to the bone of his hip. He had become friends with the girl of Mensa, the second young Malfetto in the temple, and the two of them played together when the priests weren't there. They would sneak out to the date orchards or startle the goats into a frenzy. She would toy with his long braids, tying them into elaborate designs. One day, when they were both particularly hungry, they stole peaches from the fruit bowl left before one of the altars. Oh, how good they tasted! Ripe and fat and bursting with juices. They giggled and rolled around when the priests were otherwise occupied. After all, there were three altars, and they could rotate between them. It turned into a regular habit between the girl and the boy, and they became skilled at it, until the day they stole not one fruit each, but two. That night, the boy saw his priest murmuring about him to three other priests at the temple. Then she found him, dragged him out of his bed, and ordered the others to hold him down. He screamed when she murmured soft verses to him and dug a blade into the edge of his marking. In the third memory, the boy was about to turn 12 years old. The girl found him and told him about Maggiano, a fishing village along Damaca's Red River. She told him about a boat there that left once a week for the Ember Isles, laden with a cargo of spices.
"Will you meet me there? Tonight?"
she had asked him. He nodded, eager to go with her. She gripped his hands and smiled, telling him,
"No matter what happens, we look forward. Joy is out there, beyond these walls."
That night, he wrapped some fruit and dates in a blanket and crept out of the temple. He was almost beyond the gates when he heard the girl's screams coming from near the altar. He turned back, desperate to save her, but it was too late. The boy and girl of Mensa had no need for names because they were to be sacrificed at the age of 12, the holy number. So the boy did the only thing he could. He fled the temple as the priests searched for him, and did not stop running until he reached the village of Maggiano. There, he huddled in the dark with the cargo until the boat came. As he sailed away into the dawn, he made himself two promises. One, he would always have a name, and that name would be Maggiano. And two, no matter what happened, he would carry joy with him, almost as if he were carrying her.
If one's ship can brave the stormy seas on the path from the Ember Isles to the Skylands, he shall find himself sailing in the calmest waters, so calm that he may be in danger of stranding himself. Excerpt from the journals of Captain Morin Vora. Adelina Amuteru. The following mornings dawn gray as the last clouds from Sergio's storm linger. We sail for 5 days before we reach the Falls of Laetes that separate the Sunlands from the Sealands. Then we follow the chasm for another day until we reach the spot where the ocean comes back together, and here we finally sail around the edge. Baleeras fly occasionally between the chasm's gaping mouth, as majestic as I remember them. But they also seem exhausted, their flight slower, the glow of their translucent bodies somehow dimmer. I peer at the water tumbling into the chasm. The water looks as strange as when we left, an eerie, near-black color, as if the hues of life were being sucked from its depths. Even though Violetta and I are on the same ship, and even though Sergio visits her constantly, every day, she never asks for me. I'm certainly not about to go to her myself, to give her the pleasure of turning me away. But every time Sergio comes out of her chambers, I'm there waiting, watching, every time he looks at me and shakes his head. I can't sleep tonight. The silence of the open ocean is too loud, giving too much room to the whispers in my mind. I've swallowed two mugs of herbal drink, and still they chatter away, their voices pulling me out of my sleep over and over until I finally give up and leave my quarters. I wander out onto the deck alone.
Even the sailors tending to the masts are asleep at this hour, and the seas are so still that I can barely hear the ripple of waves bumping against the hull of our ship. Not far from us sails the Tamoran ship carrying Raffaele and the daggers, where scattered torches now shine in the night. My gaze goes from their ship up to the sky. It is a clear night. Stars dot the darkness overhead. Familiar constellations of the gods and angels, myths and legends from long ago, layers and layers so thick that the sky glitters with them. The ocean mirrors their light tonight, so that we are sailing through a sea of stars. My eye settles on a constellation comprising a half circle and a long line, the Fall of Laertes. If what Raffaele had told us is true, then we will not last long in this world with our powers. No matter what happens, whether our journey succeeds or we perish along the way, I will leave this world powerless. The whispers in my head recoil violently at that thought. My hands clench and unclench against the railing. I have to find a way to avoid such a fate. There must be a path that lets me live and preserves what makes me strong. You can still turn your back on them, you can. The sound of footsteps makes me whirl around. In the dim torchlight, I can make out Violetta approaching me, a heavy cloak wrapped around her shoulders. She looks gaunt and sickly, her eyes sunken, but she's standing on her own. She freezes at my movement.
Adelina,
she says. It is the first word I've heard from her since she left me months ago. Even her voice sounds different now, fragile and hoarse like it might break at any moment. Hostile, distant. I stiffen and turn away from her. You're awake, I mutter. After so long, these are the only words I can think of to say in return. She doesn't answer right away. Instead, she gathers the cloak tighter around herself, approaches the railing, and looks up at the night sky.
Sergio said you came to Tamora to find me.
I'm quiet for a long moment. I went for many reasons. One of them happened to concern you and a rumor that you were there.
Why did you want to find me?
Violetta turns her face away from the sky and toward me. When I don't answer, she frowns.
Or did you remember me only after your invasion failed?
The ice in her voice surprises me. I suppose it shouldn't. I wanted to tell you to return to Kenetra, I reply, that it is safe for you there, and that what I did...
You wanted to tell me to return?
Violetta laughs a little and shakes her head.
I would have refused had you found me under different circumstances.
The whispers tell me not to worry about her words, that they are meaningless. But the sting of them still pains me. Look at you, I murmur, back to thinking about how noble you are.
And what about you, telling yourself you're improving these countries you march into, thinking you're doing something good?
I've never thought that, I snap, cutting her off. I do it because I want to, because I can. That's what anyone truly means when they gain power and call it altruism, isn't it? I'm just not afraid to admit it. I sigh and look away again. I half expect Violetta to comment on my outburst, but she doesn't.
Why did you want to find me?
Violetta asks again, her voice quiet. I lean heavily against the railing, searching for an honest answer. I sleep poorly when you're not around, I finally mutter, irritated. There are voices that distract me when I'm alone.
Violetta purses her lips. It doesn't matter. Here I am and here you are. Are you happy now?
She lets another beat of silence pass between us.
Raffaele told me that I've been delirious for weeks and that he only woke up after you arrived.
She says it bitterly, like she doesn't want to admit it. But it makes me look at her again, studying her expression as I try to figure out what she really thinks. She doesn't say anything more, though. I wonder whether her words mean that she mourned my absence, that perhaps she would also lie awake at night, look to the side of her bed, and ponder why I wasn't there. I wonder whether her sleep is filled with nightmares. I wait for her to leave my side and return to her quarters. But for some reason, she decides to remain on the deck with me, both of us unwilling to apologize, each of us trying to decipher the hidden messages and the other's words, neither of us wanting to spend the night on our own. So we wait together as we drift silently through the stars. By the time we reach the Estensian harbor, my Kinetran fleet has surrounded our ships on both sides and my Inquisitors are guiding us into the port. Violetta is quiet this morning. She's returned to ignoring me, and I'm satisfied to do the same. Maggiano stays by me and frowns at the approaching harbor. Even though his stance is calm, I can feel the current of fear hidden underneath. He leans slightly toward me. If Taryn is not the one we need, he is. I straighten my back and lift my head. This is the heart of my empire. I am a queen again here, and I will not be questioned. We'll have to watch another round of Raffaele conducting his tests. Maggiano grimaces at this, and I wonder again what he must have revisited during his own test. Clouds hang heavy over the city as we head to the palace. Even the air feels stifling today, something like a humid afternoon, but darker, more insidious, the signs of a different kind of storm. The daggers travel behind us, led by a patrol of Tamoran soldiers. They are uneasy, too. You can kill them all here, the whispers tell me impatiently. They are in your country, surrounded by your inquisitors. Why don't you act, little wolf? I should. A part of me thrills at the thought of seeing the betrayal on Raffaele's face. But instead I lead them onward to the palace and down toward the dungeons. As we near Taryn's chamber, Raffaele seems to slow in his steps as if the very air around us exhausts him. He must be able to sense Taryn's dark whirlwind of energy, and its effect is weighing him down. Beside him is Violetta. She seems tired from the time spent on the deck last night, because she cannot stand on her own this morning. Sergio carries her. He does so without much effort, while Violetta clings to him as if she might fall apart. At least she's awake. I force myself to look away from her. When we reach the door to Taryn's dungeon, Sergio waves away the guards posted on either side. No, he tells them, when they start to follow us in, as they normally would. We'll go alone. The guards exchange a hesitant look, but Sergio just gives them a grim nod. They bow their heads and don't challenge him. We enter the chamber. Sergio had sent word ahead of us that the inquisitors posted inside the dungeon should leave today. So the chamber is empty, the sounds of the moat's water amplified by their absence. The only figure in here sits crouched in the center of the rocky island, his tattered prison robes spread around him in a circle. He looks up when we enter. The dark shadows under his eyes seem even deeper than I remember, giving him a haunted look. Dried blood covers his wrists in a ring, and when I look closer, I can see the brighter, wetter appearance of fresh blood as well. Are you sure you want to do this? Maggiano asks as we gather at the edge of the moat. You can talk to him from here, can't you? I can, I reply, even though both of us know the real answer. But we cannot travel with someone who must be separated from us by chains and a moat. Maggiano doesn't argue. Instead, he gives my hand a subtle squeeze. His touch sends a spark of warmth through me. Raffaele glances at Violetta. I look at my sister resting against Sergio's shoulders. She stirs, her face ashen pale, then lets Sergio help her step gingerly down. Her energy lurches as she draws closer to me, and a cloud of fear hovers over her. I can't tell whether her fear is because of Taryn or me, or us both. Still, she doesn't back away. She turns her attention to Taryn's direction, closes her hand into a fist, and pulls. Taryn's eyes widen. He lets out a sharp gasp, then hunches over, his hands clawing at the rock beneath him. I recoil even as I watch this. I know the feeling well. It's as if the air has suddenly been sucked out of my lungs, and the threads that make up my body are pulled taut until they threaten to snap. Taryn lets out a soft groan, then looks at us again with hatred in his eyes. Violetta puts her arm down and takes a deep breath. She's shaking slightly. The lantern light in here highlights the trembling of her robes. Does she even have enough strength to use her power? "He's ready," she whispers. Sergio fixes the rope bridge that will take us across the moat. Taryn watches our approach, his eyes first on me, then on Raffaele. His stare lingers on Raffaele's face. I glance back at Raffaele, searching his expression for a reaction, but true to his consort training, he has resumed a calm state, his fear now a subtle undercurrent beneath a veil of steel. He meets Taryn's gaze with his own level one. If he has noticed Taryn's wrist wounds, it doesn't show. "Well, Your Majesty," Taryn says in his usual taunting tone, addressing me without withdrawing his eyes from Raffaele's face. A small smile plays on his lips, sending a chill down my spine. "You've brought a mutual enemy with you this time. Your tastes in torture seem to have evolved." "He's even friendlier than I remember," Maggiano mutters from the other side of the moat. I say nothing. Instead, I wait until we have gathered a few feet away from him, settling at the safe distance that Taryn can't reach in his chains. Taryn's eyes find me again. "Why is he here?" he asks in a low voice. I turn back to Sergio and nod. "Unchain him." Surprise flickers across Taryn's face. He stiffens as Sergio walks over, one hand resting on his sword hilt, and bends down to Taryn's wrists. Sergio twists a key in the shackles. They clatter one by one to the ground. I brace myself. Taryn lunged for me the last time I visited him in the dungeons. He may do so again now, even with his powers taken away. But instead, he just pushes himself to his feet and stares at me. "What do you want now, little wolf?" he says. At the shore across the moat, Maggiano shifts. I can sense his unease and my energy reaches for it. I let it strengthen me. I have lied to Taryn before. I can do it again. "Haven't you always hated the existence of the elites, Taryn?" I ask. "Haven't you always hoped to see us destroyed, taken to the underworld?" Taryn doesn't answer. He doesn't need to, of course. Everyone knows his answers to these questions. "Well," I reply, "I think the gods may grant your wish after all." Taryn's eerie smile vanishes. "Do not play games with the gods, Adelina," he says. "Do you want to hear more?" Taryn sneers at me. He takes a step closer, close enough that if he wanted to, he could reach out and seize my throat. "Do I have a choice?" "We can leave, of course. You can go back into your shackles. You can crouch here for all of eternity, never again seeing the light of day, never dying. That is a part of your power too, isn't it? Too strong, too invincible to die and end your own misery? What irony." I tilt my head at him. "So, do you want to hear more?" Taryn continues to stare. "Always playing games," he finally says. I glance at Raffaele. "You're going to have to trust us for a moment." Taryn laughs at that. He shakes his head. "What has trust ever meant to any of you?" But when Raffaele steps forward to place his gemstones in a wide circle around Taryn, he doesn't react. He watches, noting each of the stones. When Raffaele finishes, he steps back and folds his arms. I crane my neck too, suddenly curious. What memories will Raffaele see from Terran's past? What does he align with? What if he does not align with what we need after all? The chamber falls into silence. Raffaele furrows his brows in concentration as he studies each of the gemstones. As we look on in the darkness, three of the gems take on a subtle glow. One is white, which I instantly recognize as diamond, as ambition. Then a bold, brilliant blue. Finally, a scarlet so intense that the gem looks like it is bleeding. I release my breath. I recognize the blue glow. It is the same as one of my own alignments, the alignment to Sapientus, for wisdom and curiosity. But the scarlet... When Raffaele reaches out, Terran stiffens, then gasps. His eyes become unfocused as if he were reliving a memory. Then he winces, squeezes his eyes shut, and turns away. I watch, fascinated, reminded of my own tests. I have never seen Terran vulnerable in this way before. His mind open to not only another person, but someone who is his enemy. Again and again, Raffaele reaches out, and again, Terran flinches and backs away from him. Ambition, wisdom, and... Suddenly, Terran lets out a snarl and lunges for Raffaele. Raffaele takes a quick step away just as Sergio steps between them. His sword is drawn before I can blink. He hits Terran hard in the chest with the hilt of the sword, then shoves him roughly back. Terran stumbles and falls to his knees. I wait, heart in my throat, as Terran stays there with his head down. He's breathing hard. He doesn't say anything. Raffaele looks pale now. He nods, confirming what we already guessed. "Ruby," he says, his voice echoing in the dungeon. "For Tristius, son of time and death." His gaze wanders to me. "The angel of war." I exhale again. Terran has the missing alignment we need. "Why are you here?" Terran hisses. All hints of his taunting nature are gone now, replaced by raw anger. "What do you want? What do you want?" I take a step toward him and bend down to his eye level. "Terran," I say softly, "there is something happening to the world, to you, to me, to everyone here. The immortal underworld is seeping into the real world, poisoning everything in it." I explain what Raffaele had told me about the poison in the dark waters, the dying Baliras, his wounds that now heal more slowly than they ever have before. "We believe we are the only ones who can stop it. The elites. And you align with the immortal world in a way that we still need." Terran's head stays bowed, and somehow a part of me aches in understanding. What had Raffaele forced up from his past? "I want you to come with us." Terran lets out a broken laugh. He lifts his head, and my breath catches as his colorless eyes find mine. Windows full of madness and tragedy. "We have an unpleasant history together, little wolf," he says. "What makes you think I have any desire to help you?" "The last time we worked together, there was another standing in the way," I reply. Terran leans forward. He is so close that I can feel his breath against my skin. "The one standing between us is you," he snaps. "We can only be enemies." I suppress my hatred of him. "When we first met, you told me that I deserved to return to the waters of the underworld, that all elites are abominations, never meant to walk this world." I narrow my eye at him. "But tell me, Terran, if you are a demon, and I am a demon, abominations in the eyes of the gods, then why have the gods given me the Kenetran throne? Why do I rule the Sealands, Terran, and all armies fall before me? Why, Terran, do the gods keep rewarding me?" Terran glares at me. "You were born the son of a lead inquisitor," I say. "You have been taught all your life that you are lower than a dog, and you've believed it. Even the woman you once loved told you that you were nothing. She turned her back on you in a way that makes me pale by comparison. Then I lift my head and look straight at him. What if you are wrong? What if the gods sent you, and indeed the rest of us, not because we were never meant to be, but because we were always meant to be? It's not possible, Taryn replies calmly, but he does not answer my question. Is it possible that the gods created us in order to save the world instead of destroy it? I press, knowing the words that will weaken him. Is it possible that they created us in order to undo something broken so that we may one day sacrifice ourselves? Taryn stays quiet. So, he finally says, you want me to join you in this quest to fix the break between worlds. Why would I do this? Because we need you, I reply, and you are still the strongest elite I know. Without warning, Taryn lashes out and grabs my wrist with one of his hands. His grip is iron, painful, unyielding. I suck in my breath sharply at his touch. Sergio pulls his sword halfway from its sheath. Maggiano utters a sharp warning. I could kill you right now, Adelina, Taryn whispers. I could break every bone in your body, could crush them into powder, and there's nothing your men can do to stop me. Let that prove to you that the gods are not on your side. You are still the same quivering little girl I tied to the stake that morning. My hatred for Taryn seethes, black and churning, rising above my fear and the pain in my wrist at his grip. Behind me, Maggiano's energy stirs. I stare levelly back at Taryn. And yet here I still stand before you, your queen. My words have stirred doubt in him. There's a flicker in his eyes that I've never seen before. He is wondering whether I could possibly be right, and I am right, aren't I? The gods have blessed me. They've rid this world of the Kinetran king who despised us, then his queen who had used and manipulated us. The gods put on the throne a girl born to a father who wished her dead. They have spared my life again and again. They've given me everything. And you pushed your sister away. You murdered a man you once loved. You are an empty vessel. Nothing. The gods have given you a power that is killing you. Taryn, we are going to hand our powers back to the gods. We will fix the world by giving up our abomination. It is the only way, and it is the only mantra you have ever followed. I say it as if I were also trying to persuade myself to join this journey, that I do not fear the loss of my power, that I am not still attempting to cheat the inevitable. I have no other reason to stand beside Raffaele, nor you. I take a deep breath. This is what you've always wanted. Taryn studies me for a moment. His expression shifts from one extreme to the next, settling at last into a look I can't understand. There is a light there, behind his madness, a glimmer of something that lures him forward. This is what you've always wanted, isn't it, Taryn? I think. He releases me. Sergio loosens his grip on his sword, and the others in the chamber shift their stances. I relax, letting out my breath, trying to keep my composure. My heart hammers in my chest. Taryn gives me a slow smile. We will see who is right, mi Adelineta, he says.
Taryn Santoro. In the first memory, Taryn was 7 years old. He was in the uniform of an Inquisition Axis apprentice, a simple gray tunic and trousers, a student training to join the white cloaks that his father presided over. His hair was cut short and clean, and his eyes were still the color of the ocean. He's in one row with a dozen others, looking out at a crowd of young apprentices gathered in a courtyard of the palace, fenced in by tall statues of the 12 gods and angels. His father addressed them all. Taryn stood tall, his head held high. He was the only son of the lead inquisitor of Kinetra, and that made him better than the others, so his father said anyway. Our order has always existed to protect the Kanetran crown, his father was saying. To protect the superiority of our people above all others, and to protect the purity of our heritage. By pledging your lives to the Inquisition's order, you promise to forever dedicate yourselves to the royal family, and to guard the throne with your lives. Terran felt his little chest swell with pride. The Inquisition Axis was the most esteemed army in the world, and his father led them. He hoped that one day he could look as regal as his father did in his lead Inquisitor armor and cloak. We wage a noble war against those who are impure. Remember this, and go forth with it in your minds. Protect your country, at all costs, at whatever sacrifice. Terran closed his eyes and took a deep breath, internalizing the words. A noble war against those who are impure. Terran Santoro! His father was calling his name now. Come forward! Terran needed no second calling. He immediately stepped out of his row and made his way forward. When he reached his father, the man nodded for him to kneel, handed him his first sword, and told him to look out into the crowd. Terran obeyed. The other apprentices, who were instead given wooden practice swords rather than Terran's steel one, followed his example and knelt. Terran bowed his head and closed his eyes as his father read out the Inquisition Axis oath. He was pure, superior, and he would follow in his father's footsteps. Terran was 11 years old in the second memory. The blood fever had swept through Kanetra earlier in the year, so his eyes were no longer a pure ocean blue, but pale, so pale that they were inhuman, a complete lack of color. He stood with a bowed head and heavy heart before the funeral pyre upon which his father's body lay. The fire had spread now from the kindling to the late lead Inquisitor's clothes. Terran stayed silent as the flames roared. His father had gotten sick only after Terran did, but while Terran had managed to survive, the blood fever had killed his father in only 2 days. Terran knew it was his fault. It had to be. The gods did not make mistakes, and he knew he had to have been marked by the fever for a reason. Later that night, Terran crept out of his chambers and fled down to the palace temple. There, in the dark recesses and pools of candlelight, he knelt before the gods and sobbed. The Inquisition Axis doctrine specifically taught that survivors of the blood fever were abominations, a punishment from the gods. He was a demon now. What had he done? He whispered to the temple floor as he knelt. Before him loomed a statue of Holy Sapientus, the god of wisdom. Why, my father? Why didn't you take me too? He knelt there for 3 days, until he was thirsty and starving. How far I've fallen, he thought to himself over and over again, until the thought seemed embedded in his very being. I was once superior, and now I'm nothing. My father is dead because of me. Trash. Filth. Suddenly, in a fit of desperation, Terran grabbed the hilt of his sword and pulled it out. It was the same sword his father had gifted him on the day he joined the Inquisition as an apprentice. He took the sword, placed its blade against one of his wrists, and slashed as hard as he could. He cried out at the jolt of pain. Blood bloomed instantly against his skin. But then, the wound closed. Terran saw it close, watched with his mouth agape as one side of the slashed flesh rejoined with the other, sealing shut. The pain disappeared. Terran blinked at the sight. Then he tried slashing his wrist again. Again, the wound bloomed with blood before closing. It can't be. Terran tried a few more times, gritting his teeth at the pain, and then in horror as the pain faded almost instantly. He cut himself more and more frantically, trying to spill more of his blood, but he couldn't. Each time, the wound healed itself as surely as if it had never happened at all. Finally, Terran flung the sword away. He collapsed at the feet of Sapientus, weeping. He couldn't even end his life. He was cursed forever by the blood fever. He stayed in the temple for another day, then another. A few friends, other young apprentices, came to check on him. He pushed them away, refusing to answer their questions. He didn't want to tell them the reason why he wouldn't speak to them, that it was because he was no longer an equal, but a dog who dared to talk to a man. He didn't want to speak because he was terrified of the horrible, secret power the blood fever had left with him. The question haunted him every night he stayed in the temple. Why would the gods let him survive the blood fever marked and disgraced, and then take away the ability for him to end his life? What did they want him here for? Why were they forcing him to stay? On his last night in the temple, he drove his fist down against the ground in frustration. To his shock, the marble of the floor cracked beneath his knuckles, leaving 100 jagged lines in the stone. Terran stared, frozen. He held his hand up to the moonlight, observing that his knuckles had healed over and left no mark or injury behind at all. The gods had made him an abomination and then given him near invincibility and strength. Perhaps they have punished me for a reason, Terran thought. He knelt quietly before Sapientus for the rest of that night.